Support for Gig with Mike Redman comes from Music Connection. For 45 years, connecting artists and musicians with each other and the industry. And you can find them on the web at musicconnection.com. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Gig. I'm your host, Mike Redman. Here we are again with Mark Bonilla, Part 2. The short version is he's an incredible guitarist, artist, and human, so we won't waste time with a lot of introduction on this one. Let's just jump in. Tell me a story, if you can, about something that illustrates what it is you love about music to begin with.
Well, I can give you several. I'll give you three. Three is always a good number. I was with Keith Emerson over in Kazan, Russia, in 2008. The wall had recently, you know, been down. But the music, you know, hadn't proliferated like it has now. And so they were doing a concert over there called Concert, or was it for Peace, I think. And it was like a worldwide, and literally worldwide event where they invited musicians from every continent to come by. So there was, you know, the Tibetan monks, there were musicians from Africa, just amazing, a Ukrainian choral group that was unbelievable. And so we got invited to come over. And it was the first event that they were going to publicize nationally throughout Russia. So there ended up being about 250,000 people there when we played in the afternoon, Keith and the band. And we went back to the hotel, and the promoters came up shortly after that and looked very, they were looking very pained. And they came up and asked me, he said, look, we have a favor to ask of you. And I said, well, what do you need? And they said, well, Robert Plant decided not to do this. I don't know if it was the fact that he looked at the size of the crowd and maybe wasn't
big enough.
Not that he hasn't played, but whatever. Anyway, his band was there, but he decided not to do it. So he asked, could you sing a duet with Patti Smith, All You Need Is Love, and then sing A Whole Lot of Love? And
oh,
I said, yeah, I'll do it, because I didn't want to say no to him. You know, yeah. They were very upset that they thought, oh, this is the finale and we don't have a lead singer to do that. So, you know, and so they were happy. They walked away, and Keith leaned over and he goes, you sing that high? And I went, shit, I don't know, you know. And so I had to go up in the hotel room with a pillow, put it over my face and scream to try and get my voice up in that area, get it loosened up and all that. And then I couldn't remember if it was, you need cooling, I'm singing before schooling. Is it cooling before schooling or is it schooling? You know the song, but if you have to sing it, it's a whole different thing. So yeah. I had to refamiliarize my sequencing.
Oh, my God.
And so we get to the gig. And by then there was like, it was like a landscape of people. There was about 350,000 people at this show and being fully televised, you know, live.
Wow.
And we got up to the gate, they wouldn't let us in because of all the fireworks that they apparently had planted. So our driver got out and was able to schmooze them by vodka. You know, he pulled out his vodka. Everybody in Russia has vodka in their back pocket.
I tell you stories, but yeah.
Yeah, well, you know. All right. So he was sharing us some vodka and a cigarette with the guard. And then it was like, you know, the gates opened up when he ran. But because of the delay, I had to run right on stage and introduce myself to Patty on the stage. Like, hi, I'm Robert Plant.
Oh, God.
So,
oh, my
God. And we sang. And we pulled it off. I was actually able to hit the note. But the next day, we had the day off. And Kazan is known for its religious tolerance. There's all kinds of mosques, Russian Orthodox, Catholic, you know, Lutheran, you know, Jewish temples, everything in this city. So we were able to go into the mosque. We had to take our shoes off. And they gave us a tour of the mosque. And then they said, hey, would you like to come down into the subterranean archives to see the real stuff that we've had for, you know, hundreds of years? So we went, of course we do. You know, so we went down this stairway into this wholesome, and there are these old ladies down there that are probably about as old as the archives. Mm-hmm. And they have like the shawls on and, you know, and their burkas, and they're the ones that maintain the, you know, the artifacts.
Sure.
So I get down there. One of them spots me and shrieked and came running up, grabbed my hand and was kissing it and just spouting off in Russian. And I'm looking at my interpreter going, okay, what's going on here?
You know?
Okay. So he's quoting, he goes, she says that she saw you on TV last night. You sang like a bird. It made her cry. Her son-in-law made fun of her, but she doesn't care. And I'm like, wow. And all the other ones, when they recognized who I was from that, the night before, they were like teeny boppers. I mean, they were giddy and you know, it was like, wait a minute, there's something wrong. This was like the dialogue from one movie in another movie, you know, it was so, and they were all wanting to take pictures. They were giddy. And I went, my God, look at the power of music. You have, it spans religion, it spans race, it spans language barriers, it spans generational barriers,
all of
that. I would never have expected that from this, but that's what the power of music does. And I've never forgotten that lesson. And one that was similar to that was my wife, Joey, and I went to we had some friends, a very strange story. And again, this is why I think things are ordained for your lessons. My plumber at the time, Steve Blackmer, I told him we were going to go to Montana for a vacation. Uh-huh. And he goes, oh, hey, you got to look up my friends, Joe and Murrieta Malone. I'm like, who's Joe and Murrieta? Oh, no, they're neighbors that I grew up with down here. Uh-huh. Oh, they're great people. I went, dude, I don't even know these people.
Yeah. I'll look them up.
No, they're great. Just, you know, so he wrote down my shirt pocket, right? So flash forward there in Montana. And I felt, I don't know what I was doing, but I felt, oh, shit, I still have that piece of paper. It's that phone number. Well, he's going to ask me when I get back. So at
Did
least
call?
Call them and say hi. Yeah. So I call up and I get Murrieta on the phone. You know, she goes, hello, you know, and I said, hi. You literally don't know me from Adam, but I'm a friend of Steve Blackmore. Oh, Steve. Oh, yes. Well, come on over. You know, and it's like, well, you know, just, oh, no, here's the instructions. So, all right, we'll go. We had nothing to do that day. So he ended up literally about 2 hour driving into literally the middle of nowhere. Martinsdale, which is almost smack dab in the middle of Montana, a dirt road going back, you know, and the road, all there was a general store, a post office and a phone booth. So I get in the phone booth at the time, cause they didn't have, you know, we didn't have cell phones back then. And, or I didn't. And, called up, you know, their number saying, you know, and Joe answered and he goes, hi. Oh, yeah. Hey, where are you? And I said, well, I'm at a phone booth next to the post office. He goes, oh, look to the right. So I looked to the right and he's standing on the porch waving, you know, on his phone. So I was like, okay. There was not a lot of houses, but I didn't know which one. So anyway, so we go there and the first thing he says is, okay, first of all, you're staying the night. No argument. You're going to stay over. You know,
okay.
We could have been serial killers, but they a friend of Steve's, a friend of ours. So we ended up having a great visitation with him. And he says, hey, I'm going over to the Hutterite colony. Do you want to come? I do business with them. And the Hutterites are much like the Amish people, but they're German.
Okay.
And they're isolated. They're, you know, they're a little more isolated than the Amish. But they sell their wares and stuff in town, and he does work with them. So we went over there, and again, another dirt road back all the way, and we get into this place, and this is whole colony. And all the men are over here with the suspenders, the beard, the whole nine yards, and they're building a new schoolhouse over here, all the men. All the women apparently are down making rhubarb wine, which is quite effective.
That's really interesting.
But when we got out of the car, all the kids came up and were, like, touching us, like, like we landed in a spaceship, you know, these outbuilders, you know, and they had never seen any, you know, they don't see those people, especially with hair and all of that. So this girl came up and she says, hey, would you like to come down? And we're making wine down here while they're doing their business. So Joey and I went down to this place and these girls they're all making rhubarb wine in this large thing. And they're all singing to pass the time. They sing religious songs and they're in this gorgeous 3-4 part harmony, beautiful madrigal stuff that was just like unbelievable. And I said, wow, this beautiful stuff. She goes, do you sing? I said, well, yeah, I'm a musician. Apparently they can't play. They're not allowed to play musical instruments. The men can, but they can't.
Oh, so interesting.
Runs out of the door in the back. And we were talking about it. And then about 5 minutes later, she comes in with this pilfered guitar, acoustic guitar, right-handed. Uh-huh. So, you know, thank you. I'm left. right-handed, five strings on it. And they said, let's go down, let's sneak out. We snuck out of the building, went down around the other side of the hill over to the old abandoned schoolhouse that they were replacing. Ran inside, pulled all the shades down, and they're like, do you know to play rock and roll? Can you play rock and roll?
Oh, my God.
You know? And it's like the forbidden fruit, right? You know? So I said, like, what? Like Chuck Berry? Yeah, yeah. Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry. So I started playing, like, Johnny B. Sung. And they started reeling around, you know, like, in these, in these satanic undulations. They weren't satanic.
Sounds like
they
a Stephen King novel.
Oh, you know, I'm looking at Joey like, are you believing this shit? You know, it was just unbelievable. They were just in ecstasy. And then they would, then we would stop. They would clap. Then they would sing this beautiful, like, three or four part harmony. And we would sit there and just be in awe of them. We did that for about, you know, 20 minutes. And all the little kids were trying to, like, look in, and they were yelling at them in German to fuck off, you know, and all this. But again, the power of music transcending that kind of cultural barriers. You can't, you know, I mean, those are lessons for you to, you know, because if I hadn't just pulled out that one sheet from my plumber, maybe I should call, I would have missed, or both of us would have missed that entire experience. So those things are set up for you in the order. If you don't say yes to things, you know, you're like, if I hadn't said yes to singing, if I hadn't said yes to, you know, calling that number. So when those things are presented to you, always say yes. You know, it's better that you do something and wish you hadn't than not have done it and wish you had. It's much better because you deny yourself too much life, you know, and especially lessons like that that secure the power of music.
But I want to jump to a totally different thing and how you kind of came into my path. And it's through Steve Porcaro, Toto fame. And I was watching Justified. I actually just, who did I just interview last week? Michael Dinner.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and Graham Yost. And
I love Graham. Graham's a huge prog fan, by the way. Huge progressive rock fan.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you a story about him. Because it's
Let's tell everybody who he is. He's a executive producer, writer, showrunner in Hollywood. He's important enough that when I was on the phone with him one day, he says, hey, Mike, I'll be back. It's Tom calling. And it was Tom Hanks to talk about a new show. So go ahead.
Okay, so that's good that you say that, because it prefaces the fact that he is a very big player in Hollywood, right? And just nothing but quality work. I mean, everything that he's done, from Mr. In-Between to Band of Brothers, you know you're getting a quality show and quality writing, all of that with him, right? And God bless him, he was the showrunner on Justified and was running interference for everybody on the, you know, for some reason when they give you a desk and a secretary and your name on the window, they automatically think they've been imbued with musical insight. It's not the case, all right? But they think it is, and they have to justify their salary. So they like to render their opinions. And oftentimes there would be conflicting opinions on the same cue that Steve and I would be working on. Like, this needs more of that. And the other guy goes, no, it needs less of that. You know. And so Graham came to us early on. And he says, look, you guys are doing great work. People are raving about the soundtrack. Don't you worry about that. I'll handle those guys. He was our firewall throughout the entire, all the seasons that we did Justified. So I can't say enough good things about this gentleman. We went, he was a huge Emerson fan, Keith Emerson fan. So Steve had called one day. He goes, hey, man, do you think that maybe you could talk Keith into going out to dinner? Because Graham is coming down with his brother from Canada. And I know they would love, you know, be totally great if they could meet him. And I said, let me call Keith. And I call Keith and I explained to him. And he goes, oh, yeah, no problem. So we went out to dinner. Now, these guys, Graham, you know, Hollywood player, right? He's literally doing a Chris Farley interviewing Paul McCartney, where he's sitting on his hands. He can't sit still. And he's like, so Keith, like when you were doing Lucky Man, like that, yeah, total fanboy. I loved it. It was like, and we're all that. The thing is, given the right person with John Lennon, it was Chuck Berry. John couldn't sit still on the Mike Douglas show. He's just grabbing his crotch the whole time. Just, I can't believe it's Chuck. You know, it walks and it talks, you know. And it's so both Graham and his brother and Keith was completely cool with all that. He answered every question. We closed the club. Everybody had gone and we were the only table left. You know, they were sweeping, you know, all of that stuff. So it was great to see that even guys like Graham, they're fanboys, you know, with something really, you know, we all have our heroes. Doesn't matter what we do in life, because to us, we're just the same people we always were. You know, other people see us differently. We're not. We're just kids, you know, all of us. And this is so great to see that. It was so great to see. And actually, Keith did a piece. Actually, I surprised Graham. I had Keith do a piano piece for one of the ending cues in Justified.
Justified, awesome show. I'm hoping that everybody that listens to this has seen it. If they haven't, they probably should. And then you have City Primeval, so
yep.
Their new show. But yep. Steve was working on that project, and I started watching it. And the first thing that stuck out to me was, you know, the style of the score. But the first thing that really stuck out to me was the guitar work. And being a composer myself and a guitarist, I thought, you do not write this stuff. You know what I mean? You know, when you're writing a score, you don't write that. The guy that's playing guitars on this it was so well layered. The recording itself was so nice. That's when I asked Steve, I said, so man, who played guitars on this? He goes, you know, Mark Bonilla. And I'm like, well, I've heard his name, but I've never really, you know, I'm an East Coast guy, you know. Mm-hmm. we don't
commingle. Never the twain shall meet.
Yeah, we don't commingle with those West Coast guys, even though I lived in San Francisco. Would you walk somebody through that might be listening to this that may think, hey, you know, I want to play guitar, I want to do scores and TV shows and stuff. Kind of what just the process is?
Well, you know, obviously it makes a difference who your showrunner is, the guy that, you know, a girl that runs the entire event. You know, how much confidence do they have in your ability to trust what you have? And that's why a lot of directors will keep with the same composer throughout different series and different films, because they know they trust their baby being handled by someone else, you know, without any negative surprises. So that being a given, even if it's new, you need to be able to obviously understand the role of soundtrack music. And usually you have to become in parts. You're always it's another character. In other words, with regard to Justified, you know, we had Raylan Givens, who was the sheriff, and
Boyd,
or the marshal rather, so I try to assign an instrument to each character, much like, remember Peter and the Wolf? You listen to Peter and the Wolf by Prokofiev. Every character had an instrument, right? You have to be able to. So I would assign a role. I would also keep in mind what the scene is about. In other words, what's the motivation of the scene? Because you're always a character in that role. Now, there are supporting characters that happen that are not in every scene, but they're important to the story. You are in, you know, a lot of the scenes. Sometimes you go, we don't need music here. It would distract. Because once you put music in, there's a separation of reality. There becomes a veil that is pushed over the music or what the music does, where it's more philosophical now, or it's now generating a different motivation than what's actually being said. That's why some scenes you don't want any music behind, because it's crucial that it's dead reality. And once you put music in, it separates. It separates you somehow, and you know, whether it's, you know, if you're in a horror film and you what you always find is, you know, you get the low drone and the, you know, the ominous as they're walking through the house, but you know that it's not ready for the shock yet, or the guy's not going to come out because there's music playing, right? Once the music stops and there's this silence, then bam, then you get that anticipation, right? And that's the absence of music is just as important as the presence of music. And so as a music composer in soundtrack, you have to understand where those are and realize that you don't want to detract from the script. You don't want to detract from the acting. You don't want to detract from the cinematography, any of that stuff. You want to add to it. And you sometimes have to slip in behind it and sneak in and become musical tofu, where you're absorbing the flavor of the scene, you know, but you're not imposing your will. Because a lot of times if you're listening, you know, and then if there's an action scene, yes, then of course you're going to pull up and you're going to do all those things, because now the dialogue's not what's important as much as the action. Then you can always add to the kinetic feel of that, or you can play against it, what they call playing against it. Like the scene in Platoon, when you have Willem Dafoe running out of the forest, and you have all of these, you know, they have helicopter fire coming in and killing all the Viet Cong behind him, and he's doing this number, and you get Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings playing over it, which completely tells you about the tragedy of war as opposed to the action of war. So you as a composer have a lot of power when it comes to how a scene is interpreted, but you have to be really understand the script, the characters, the motivation, the arc of the story, all of those things before you even put pen to paper or all of that stuff. You really need to watch it and understand where you're needed and where you're not needed. It's different than if you're just playing and everything's standing on its own. You have to play in tandem with the script, the acting, the lighting, the cinematography, all of those things. And usually you're the last one that's been given the baton. So when you're running that relay race, you know, and it starts out with production, and then they hand it off to editing, and then they hand it off to color correction, then they hand it off to this. You're the last guy, man. You're the last guy. And because of that, the time it gets compressed, because a lot of times stuff doesn't get done in time. They have to do reshoots. You don't get it. It with all of that wonderful time that all the other ones had to produce it as much. So it doesn't matter how long a time it has to broadcast on a particular day. You need to get your ass around that track quick. So in order to do that, it's stressful. It's very stressful. But you have to, again, understand that this stuff comes through you. Every week that we started a new episode, we knew we had to hand it in at the end of the week, right? It didn't matter how much music or how less we knew we had to get it done. It was a blank canvas every time. And what I would do and how I would come up with stuff is I would watch it, you know, watch it two or three times, the episode to get a feel for it. We have cue sheets that had where, you know, your 1-1, 1-2, all the where they wanted the music.
Yeah.
Which is,
they're spotting and, charts. Yep.
Yeah. And I would then go in. Because we did this in the fall. I would go in and sit and watch NFL. I'd be in there, you know, with my guitar. I'd be watching the Raiders, you know, and I'd be playing away mindlessly, not concentrating what I'm doing. Yeah. And all of a sudden, pause. Digital recorder over here. Click. Click. Okay, back to the game. And I would sit there and watch, you know, all Sunday. I would get riffs and things that I knew, oh, that would be great in this part. That would be great in here. You know, the good place was for the ideas to then germinate, but it was done through flow. It was all flow. I wasn't thinking about it. Yeah. And then I would go in and see where that stuff could fit. And then, okay, that can fit here, but we have a gap here where that won't fit. I'll write something now. So you were still flowing in the other room in the studio. But often I would get the themes from people by just, it's a form of meditation.
Yeah.
This is why when you're driving, you'll get ideas, right? You go, oh God, I got to write that down. You're driving, you're trying to do it in your phone, whatever it is. When you're running, when you're doing something that is one purpose that you're doing, like it could be exercising, running, any of that stuff. It's a form of meditation. You're not thinking about the other stuff. And that's when your ideas come in, because you basically unkink the hose, the water, and it all shoots out, you know, and that's what we do. And so you have to find the ways to unkink your hose and to let the stuff flow through you. And by the end of the week, you'll have what you need. You know, and then you can go in and tool things and make things hit on a certain cut, you know, all of those things. you know, this, you use both sides of your brains when you're doing soundtrack stuff. You know, you're mathematical and you're creative. So
when you're doing this particular show, were you writing a lot of times just right next to Steve, or were you guys bringing in ideas?
We did that. He would give me, he said, I'm going to take these, you take these. And you know, sometimes, and then of course, Steve, keyboard player, he's got 10 fingers, right?
Yeah.
He writes an acoustic guitar part, 10 fingers, and I have to try to do the other. I was like, you know, impossible to play, right? Amazing to listen to, right?
Uh-huh.
So I would have to literally go in there on some of the stuff that he wrote to give me to play. Like, I have this guitar thing, which are always, it was amazing. He was so good at that. He had such good instincts as far as guitaristic, you know, approach. It never sounded like a keyboard player playing an acoustic guitar. It sounded like just an amazing acoustic guitar player. So I was able to then, through editing and retuning, to get those things to sound so that certain notes would ring through. Because, you know, when you're doing this, you have clusters that ring where you only have six strings to ring. So I would have to, it was meticulous some of the time of going in and layering those things and jacking them around so that I did justice to his composition, which was, I would curse his name while we were doing it.
Oh yeah. Justice on Justified. Yeah.
It was just one of those things where he was always writing great stuff. And then I would write, you know, whatever, let's say, well, just for the sake of argument, like 50% here, I would write 50%, he would write 50%. And then I would give those to him and he would go, oh man, I'm going to put this thing over the top of that. So in that way we cross-pollinated.
Gotcha.
But, you know, we knew that, we're the kind of guys that we can get together to generate something and get ideas across. Then we go, okay, we're going to piss off now. We're going to go to our separate caves and do our thing without interruption and then come back and see, you know, and that's how we worked. And we worked beautifully like that.
You're so articulate and precise in your acoustic playing, which I'm hands down the worst acoustic guitarist ever put on this planet, but I sure could appreciate it. It was just a compliment.
Well, it's, you know, and for me too, and remember this also, that you want to see, for me, I was forced to learn banjo. I was forced to learn, you know, mandolin, blues harp. I did all this. I just went out and bought that stuff. So I'm going to need it for this show, you know? Steve was caught by surprise, you know, because he was doing the show. All of a sudden, there was all this guitar stuff that he calls me up. He goes, dude, you got to help me, man, because, you know, they want a lot of guitar on this. I said, fine, let's do it, you know. But I had to push myself in certain areas because it was, for one, it was cheaper, you know, and because I could just get it done. You know, I wouldn't have to wait to hire somebody. We did hire, you know, we had you know, proper fiddle, you know, all that. But we would, you know, again, I just decided to do things myself, learn things myself. And I did accordion, whatever it was. You know, I had Keith's accordion over there. And so I would play that. Wow. And, a lot of times getting out of your comfort zone, you don't play the same eddies and currents of stuff that you know how to play. So you come out with things that are maybe a little bit unorthodox, definitely less busy because you don't have the chops to do anything impressive, but much better for the soundtrack stuff. So, you know, I was pushing myself in ways that I really hadn't gone, which is the whole point.
Yeah.
You know, go somewhere where you haven't been and you'll be able to catch that edge of discovery on a soundtrack.
Let's just for a second, let's go way back to Toy Matinee. Like I said, I'm an East Coast guy. I lived up north of San Francisco for about 8 years. On the East Coast, we had our bands. You guys had your bands out there, sort of. And Toy Matinee was a big West Coast band. Most people that I've talked to recently, because I was actually thinking about this, they said nobody'd ever heard of them. I had a friend that was selling studios, and he sent me Toy Matinee one day, and he goes, this is one of the bands out here that's cool. I was so blown away by that band. I listened to them every day. Some of the tracks that you guys did, where somebody resynced the YouTube video to the music.
That was quite impressive. The fact
God! And you guys were so friggin' tight live. I guess what's some of your most memorable moments of playing at that time, and maybe something about the genius behind Kevin Gilbert and
Kevin and I met through Keith Emerson. Keith brought me to the studio back in San Jose, and Kevin didn't know who the hell I was. But the fact that Keith brought me in, you know, and I had just met Keith like 2 days before that.
Really?
So, wow. Yeah, that's a story in its own, but going to, Kevin's, you know, the studio, and we were at Robert Berry's, studio, and, we played something. I played something. He said, all right, come on in. You know, and he was with his arms folded and like, okay, let's see what you have. And whatever I played, and I don't know what it was, he went, oh, he said, play that again immediately. Exactly that. And he hit the record button. So I guess whatever it was is exactly what he was hearing.
Yeah.
So that was the first, I got like the first perk that way. And we went out to dinner that night. And we were talking around the table about reverb in music these days and how there's too much of it. We're really into like dry stuff, you know, and yeah. like the early Yes albums, you know, where you heard,
yeah, yeah.
You heard in the studio and they were just so tight and everything. And I said, yeah, I said, you know, nowadays, you know, with you know, the glam rock, all this stuff, it sounds like it basically sounds like the last 10 or like last 15 seconds of Pleasant Valley Sunday.
Well, it's everything swimming, yeah.
Where everything is like, you know, and he goes, my God, because I use that example. I say exactly that. I say, Pleasant Valley, I say exactly. He says, what, are you a Monkees fan? I went, oh, man, I love them. You know, I went, Meet the Monkees, you know, the Second Monkees, Headquarters, Birds and Bees of the Monkees. Yeah, yeah. And he goes, I can't believe it. You're like, I know. He says, I had to play that shit in my closet. I said, me too, along with my Tiny Tim record. I get it, you know. But we were also into Gentle Giant. So we bonded immediately after
that.
Wow,
that's cool.
And just, we basically had the same, pretty much the same vinyl collection. Mm-hmm. He went back to LA. I stayed up in the Bay Area, but we were calling each other all the time and like, you know, 4 or 5 hour calls, you know, just talking about whatever.
Yeah.
Getting to know each other. And I decided at the time I was working with Ronnie Montrose on my first solo album for Guitar for the Practicing Musician. Ronnie was my mentor growing up. After high school on out, and he financed me because he said, I got to get you out of these nightclubs, man. I got to get you, you need a shot, you know.
No, that's nice.
So we went. So I said, I want you to produce this album, you know. Mm-hmm. And so he said, well, move down here or come down, you know, to my place in Studio City, Sherman Oaks, and we'll just do it. And so we went to his place. And he had completely converted his complete living room into a studio without telling his landlord. Oops. And we went to Pat Leonard's studio, Johnny Yuma, to record the drums. Troy Licata did the drums, and Don Frank did the drums there. And Keith came down to play piano on White Noise, and he was there. And then we did the rest of it at Kev's living room, which is why it says on the record, recorded in Kev's living room. And we got to know each other really well, and, you know, we were spending basically every minute, you know, that whole summer. And he said at the end, he says, hey, look, you know, they want us to go out and promote this Toy Matinee record. And could you go out and tour Japan mm-hmm. with me? Just a trio, or not a trio, but a duo. Excuse me. So whatever it was. Anyway, okay, so he said, yeah, let's go to Japan. So we did. We came back, we added Spencer Campbell, and we did a radio tour. Then we came back, and we added Tos Panos and Sheryl Crow, and we went out and toured. But it was great because Kevin, to me, was like a musical brother, closer than I had ever had mm-hmm. as far as things we heard together, the sense of humor, all of that stuff. I had never met anyone up to that point that I felt I had to play up to. It was great. You know, I was always kind of like, come on, guys, you know, you don't hear the, you know, it where I was up in the Bay Area. I always felt like I don't take this the wrong way, but the smartest guy in the room, meaning I tried to get these other guys to play shit and they just didn't hear it or they couldn't, you know, they didn't understand it. And I didn't consider myself smart. It was just like, they're not hearing what I'm hearing. Mm-hmm. And Kevin was the first person that I worked with that heard exactly what I was hearing. And we would raise and call each other. And Keith Emerson was the same way after that. We had a relationship like that, too. They're very rare in your career or in your life where you find it's like really is like your best man, you know, for your wedding. You know, it's that kind of thing where you guys just you're born out of the same DNA substance. And although there are differences, and that's what was great, too, is the fact that I learned a lot from Kevin. Hopefully he learned something from me. Definitely learned things from Keith, you know, but so it was just a great time where we were hitting on all cylinders. And full credit to the guys that actually did the studio, Tim Pierce. And this is one thing I always would try to tell people, like, hey, you were great on the Toy Matinee. I was like, no, I didn't do the Toy Matinee. I did the live. Tim Pierce did the studio stuff, yeah. Okay? Because I would get irked, and I don't know how Tim felt about it, because I'm sure people said, oh, Benita's saying that he's and like, no, I would never.
When the video, if I put a video version of sound, I'll make sure I put it right at them. Did not play on the album, guys.
Did not play.
I played his parts.
Yeah, no, because Tim's guitar playing was just phenomenal. And Guy
it was,
Pratt,
absolutely.
And Brian McLeod, who actually Ronnie Montrose introduced us when he lived up in the Bay Area. And he and I, again, connected a big time up there and had a band together before coming down here. So the fact that Brian was, I said, hey, how you been? I haven't seen you in a while. You know,
wow.
Brian is this tremendous human being. All of them were, you know.
Yeah.
And Pat, you know, all of them were great. That was Toy Matinee. I was, like I said, I was honored to be in there, and I brought some things to it maybe. But you know, I always try to make that stipulation that you know, the credit where credit's due, man. You know, and Tim, phenomenal to this day. He's phenomenal player.
What is some of the advice you give to an up-and-coming musician that aspires to have a long career as a performance guitarist? What is some of the advice about how to get along with others, about networking yourself, you know what I mean, philosophically too?
One, you always want to try and be the solution to someone's problem, never the source. Mm. Real important. I learned that in soundtrack writing, in you know, movies and band stuff. You know, whatever band I was in, I always wanted to create, you want to create a dependence for your goodwill. In other words, I tried never to create a problem. If there was an issue that I had, I would try once, solve it on my own, you know, whatever that happened to be, or I would figure out some way to circumnavigate the issue without agitating somebody. You know, I didn't want to be the prima donna in the band, any of that stuff. And that holds true to this day. So being a solution as opposed to a problem is a very important thing, because people will then get a feel of who you are and going, oh, yeah, like Greg Bissonette, one of the sweetest guys on the planet. And one of the reasons, beyond his extraordinary abilities as a drummer, is his personality. He's always positive. He's always uplifting. He's always validating. Every time that I play with him, I feel better than I am. You know, in other words, he's just vibes everybody in the band, you know, so you just want to play with them because you want to look forward to the endorphin rush, you know. And there's several guys like that. Lee Sklar is like that. Thomas Lang is like that. I can think of a million, you know, of these, not a million, actually, no, yeah. I won't say that, but there are several of the people I play with. That's why I do this. And I've never wanted to, and this is another thing, is never involve yourself in a project where you feel subtracted from when you leave its presence. You must always feel added to. And that goes true with your friends, your, you know, any of that stuff. Don't put yourself through that. It doesn't matter how much money you're making. You know, it will take a piece of your soul. So you always, I made that decision a long time ago that I didn't want to do anything where I felt like I'd been siphoned out spiritually. You know, I always wanted to feel like that was great. You know, that was a great thing. It was an uplift. Everything was an uplift. That keeps the modicum of fun, because even if you've been doing this for a long time, and you're the reason for art, and you have to remember this, that art in and of itself, it's not just the creation of art that's art. It's the creation of art in spite of all of the elements that are seemingly conspiring against you creating that art, whether it's financial, whether it's whether it's relationships, whether whatever, if it's gear, money, any of that stuff, things will work against you. They worked against Michelangelo. You know, he wanted to paint. He didn't want to paint the Sistine Chapel, but he had the bishops, you know, and the cardinals yammering him to the point that he drew one of them in hell on the Sistine Chapel.
Did he really?
Yes, his face is in hell. Yeah, yeah. But what I'm saying is, this is an age old issue, you know, where no matter who, what composer, whatever, there's always limitations, you know, whether you can you have the gear to do it, whether you have the finance to do it, whatever it is, your creation ultimately is done in spite of all of those elements that are pushing against you to do it. And that's what the real art is. It isn't just creating art in a vacuum. You'll never have that. You'll always have these issues as a musician, especially. You'll have band members that are working against you, whatever it is. Try to surround yourself with like-minded people that love it like you do. It'll be worth the effort to search them out. And when you're doing these things, also learn to, if you don't scare yourself once a day, you're not really growing. And you need to, like what David Bowie said about going out, a good place to be is out in the ocean far enough where your toes barely touch the sand, you know, so you have a little contact, but that wave can pull you and the swells can make you go places that you normally wouldn't go. That's a wonderful adage. And you have to do that. You have to achieve, and you'll get people saying, no, you know, it's a brutal business, all this. That has nothing to do with it, because you have a call. If you have a calling, that's what it is. It doesn't matter. The calling doesn't care about extraneous circumstances. The calling is the calling. The things that you have, the ideas you have in your head, those things that bark at you at night, that repeat on a loop, those are people calling you to express. You know, they don't care about your financial situation. They don't care about your political climate. You need to get that stuff out, because you have a little truth gland in here that resonates when you're on your life's path. If you're not on your life's path, you're working a day gig, you know, or something where you think you have to make ends meet. I get that. I did the same thing, but I knew I wasn't on the right path. It resonates when you're on the right path. In other words, when you're walking a tightrope, and you have that balance beam, right? When it's right in the middle, you can feel when you're right on balance, and you don't have to compensate with weight. That's when you know you're on your life's path. And don't compromise. In other words, take a piece of a match, light the tightrope behind you, so the only way you can go is forward. Don't be looking for exit signs, any of that shit. Focus is what it takes, and you're going to get things that are going to try and pull you off. It doesn't matter. Do not be afraid to fail. If you walked on a curb, and you can easily walk on a curb, you can walk on a curb, right? There's no problem. If you take that curb and you make a big wall out of it that goes up 500 feet, you think you could walk across that thing? No. And let's say there's no wind shear, there's no nothing else. It's the same thing. You'd be really hard pressed to walk across it. What's the difference? The only difference, not physiological, not physical. It's the same distance. The only thing is your fear of failure is what'll fuck you up. That'll make you lose your balance. It's going, what if I fall? What if I fall? Right. But when you're on a curb this high, you don't give a shit about falling. It'll hurt for a minute. So you have to understand that you always want to bring that wall down to the size of a curb. Don't worry about it. Just go across it. You know you can. The only person that's going to defeat you is you. And if you can establish victory over that, no one else can defeat you. If you can establish victory over yourself, that's your hardest enemy right there. And always steer into your skid, you know, like be adventurous, you know, try take chances. But at the same time, find a way to make sure the car doesn't overturn. And ride it then, and then go on to the next adventure, because that's it's all waiting for you, you know. But don't be afraid. Fear will kill anything. If you can get rid of that, you're good to go.
I've enjoyed this interview probably more than most I've done. This is
thank you. They're good questions, though. You know, it takes two people to have a conversation.
The way you think, I just love the way you think.
I've been very fortunate to have surrounded myself with the players and the friends that I have. I never take it for granted. Every day I thank God for it, you know, that I've been able to get as far as I have. And I'm not world famous or any of that stuff, but I've never suffered from creative poverty. I've never suffered from any of that stuff. I've never suffered from lack of appreciation by my peers. I've been fortunate enough that I've been respected by them, and that's great. I mean, you can't ask for anything more than that. These guys are all, and girls, they're all tremendous artists and beautiful friends that you can hang afterwards, you know, and it shows when you get on stage. It shows what your relationship is, you know, and if you're having fun on stage, then that just, it spreads like wildfire to the crowd. you know, they know you're having a good time up there, and you're having a good time because you just hung together, you know, before and after. It's you can't underestimate the value of friendship in this business. It's really important. It'll get you through your tough times, and there'll be tough times, but those times are there for you to learn. Embrace everything. You know, it may not seem it at the time, but you always live life looking forward, but you always only can understand it by looking backwards. So you might as well go forward.
I just want to thank you again, especially since you're out there working, for taking the time to talk to me, and much luck in the future. And I'm sure we'll be in touch at some point here.
Well, listen, yeah, it was a pleasure. And thank you for intelligent questions and all that, letting me rant for a couple of hours.
Take care, my friend. If you like longer podcasts that are a bit more in-depth with some of my guests, please let me know. You can connect with me on my website, gigwithmikeredmond.com, or on Facebook, Instagram. I'd love to hear from you. Take care.